Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rutan.
And Ken, once again, we are confronted with a week of news in which the seriousness of the subject really overwhelms everything else.
Well, you know, of course, we were going to talk about the health care repeal vote.
That was to be this week.
We're going to talk about the new election for the new Republican National Chairman, which is Friday.
Michael Steele's big moment.
But I think there are other things that deserve our attention and deserve the listener attention.
Let's get right into it. There has been an absolutely constant outpouring of not only grief for the victims and hope for Gabrielle Giffords, who is struggling to recover from these wounds, and the other wounded victims. But there has also been almost a concomitant and equal outpouring of political back and forth over who's, in some sense or another, contextually at blame or at fault.
That happened within minutes of the shooting.
Absolutely.
It wasn't even, you didn't have to wait for the Obama appearing at the memorial service.
Oh, it happened the very Saturday
that
the shooting took place.
Immediately, the first thing I heard, of course, by many broadcasts, including NPR's, was that Gabrielle Giffords was killed. And that was just...
It was misinformation.
My point is that it was just horrific from day one, but immediately it became a day of finger-pointing that it was the Tea Party's fault, that it was the right wing's fault, that it was Sarah Palin's fault, that it was the left wing's fault, that it was a health care vote fault. Basically, it was a nonstop of finger-pointing. The first thing we keep thinking of is other terrible tragedies and other rising to the occasions by the president. We think of President Ronald Reagan after the Challenger.
We will never forget them. Nor the last time we saw them.
We think of Bill Clinton after Oklahoma City.
You have lost too much, but you have not lost everything.
But then the country seemed...
Or for that matter, George W. Bush after 9/11, really his finest hour as president.
Exactly, the bullhorn speech down at Ground Zero.
I can hear you. The rest of the world hears you.
We talked about Bill Clinton not being relevant in 1995 and President Bush being a 50% president in September.
Prior to these disasters.
Right, and yet both, I mean, I hate to use these in stark political terms.
At the very least, they were pivot points, they were hinges, and Bill Clinton began his comeback.
Remember, he was talking about whether he was relevant or not.
There was a question at a press conference at the White House. Do you really feel relevant to the process on Capitol Hill anymore?
The president is relevant here, especially an activist president.
But he didn't seem terribly important. Until the Oklahoma City tragedy, which was, of course, on a much different scale here. We're talking about 168 victims killed in that federal building bombing. But the president had, in a sense, a two-track response. One was the national mourning response, and he gave that marvelous speech.
Great speech.
At the memorial in Oklahoma City. But he also had another track, which, while it wasn't blatantly political, it was much more pointed about whom he held responsible for the political discourse of 1995.
I believe it was in Michigan. It was a speech not too long after in Michigan, and basically he blamed the loud voices on talk radio.
They leave the impression that, by their very words, that violence is acceptable. You ought to see. I'm sure you are now seeing the reports of some things that are regularly said over the airwaves in America today.
He didn't say conservative radio, but everybody knew what he was talking about.
Well, he was talking about Rush Limbaugh.
Exactly, right.
Everyone thought he was talking about Rush Limbaugh, including Rush Limbaugh, who immediately wrote something saying, this is not my fault,
right,
and defending himself and making good points about why there was a huge difference between even the harshest of his rhetoric and an act such as the bombing in Oklahoma City.
By the way, speaking of Oklahoma City, I don't mean to cut you off right here, but I remember in the immediate aftermath after Oklahoma City, everybody said, we know these are Muslim extremists responsible for Oklahoma City, and the anger and the immediate finger-pointing we saw after Saturday's horrific shootings in Tucson, it was, oh, it's immediately the right wing, it's them. We just love to assign blame without even just sitting back and waiting for some facts to come out.
But that is completely human nature. Nobody... And any kind of a moment of crisis of this kind or in reaction to any kind of a
But these are responsible
horrific...
people I'm talking about,
well,
ostensibly
but,
responsible
but,
people.
But people, right after the Challenger, there was a search for a scapegoat. Somebody didn't do something right. That there had to have been failures of a criminal nature on the part of the people who put it together. There was a big set of hearings about it. People want someone to blame when they have this kind of a blow.
I remember after Pearl Harbor, a lot of people blamed the Japanese.
Actually, after Pearl Harbor, there were
commissions,
enormous
there were commissions, yes.
Mountains of blame assigned on all kinds of directions, including people accusing FDR of having
deliberately
set it all
to
up
get us into the
to get
World
us
War
into
II.
The war right, when exactly. he really wanted to fight the Germans.
I mean,
there are books about all
right,
this.
Right, right.
So I don't think you're ever going to see a situation in which a horrible event of this kind does not produce a certain amount of ugly political
it
fallout.
It just felt like there was more national unity
and I agree
after
with,
other
well,
things.
I agree with
this.
You that it seemed to be much more immediate, and I have a convenient scapegoat for that.
Okay.
The internet.
Yes, I agree. Absolutely.
I believe it was partly the internet and also partly cable television, because within the hour, people who make it their business, and I mean that quite literally, to encourage conflict and to encourage people to flame the other side, were at it because that's what they do.
And I think the strength of President Obama's speech at the Tucson service was that he clearly tried to tamp that down. Now, obviously, there are some people who would have loved for him to blame one side or the other, and we know what side we're talking about here, but he didn't play that game because clearly the ugliness in the aftermath of Tucson came from both sides.
That's right. And by the way, I thought the president's speech as written and in a strict sense as delivered was marvelous, that it was well-toned, that it was not pinning blame, that it was asking everyone to be worthy of the finest ideals represented not only by Congresswoman Giffords but also by this 9-year-old child.
I want our democracy to be as good as Christina imagined it. I want America to be as good as she imagined it. All of us, we should do everything we can do to make sure this country lives up to our children's expectations.
But you just said something, Ron, was interesting. You said as written, as delivered. Explain that.
What I mean is as received in the hall and as perceived then by people watching on television, listening on the radio, was in some senses clouded by the audience response. Now, this is not meant to criticize the emotions of the people who were there in the audience. And I don't think the president would have had any real way of saying to people, just be a little bit more calm, cool out,
cheering,
a little bit.
It
sounded too much like a rally.
Almost like a pep rally. Did you think of immediately the funeral service?
I did in 2002 for
Paul Wellstone. And, of course, everybody spoke. And everybody started booing Republicans.
And they booed the Republicans. And it was ugly. It was nothing like what we saw in Tucson.
Some of this is apocryphal. But according to myth, this is what really turned the tide towards Norm Coleman against Walter Mondale, the Wellstone replacement.
Obviously, Norm Coleman was neck and neck with Paul Wellstone at the time that Wellstone died in a plane crash. This was not the only factor. Walter Mondale was a curious choice to suddenly leap into the breach. He was long past the point where he was being seen as a great champion of Minnesota. It was a different kind and a strange kind of
case.
And
it was right before an election when tempers were rising.
The thing in Tucson was quite different, but what reminded me of Minnesota in 2002 was this sense that the crowd was there for something different from what was available to them. They wanted something to make them feel better. They wanted something that they could cheer. They were enthusiastic about having the president there in Tucson, and that, in some senses, led them astray, took them out of the proper mood of response and, well, the funereal response that would be expected in a situation like
this. Well, just as Sarah Palin made it all about her, and we'll talk about Sarah Palin in a few minutes. But
will we?
Yes, we will. But I wanted to, as I was sitting and watching the president's speech on television, I guess I just wanted to cry because I just was so overwhelmed by the hopelessness of the whole thing. I thought the speech was excellent because, I mean, after all, Gabrielle Giffords was the headline and probably why President Obama went there. But it's the people who did not survive that day. The only thing I didn't like about Obama's speech is that I understand that he had to read off all the victims who survived and who did not. It just went on. I think it just dissipated the emotion that I was hoping for or waiting for.
What I liked about the speech was the sermonic aspect of it.
I agree.
The biblical references, the appeal to people's best nature, and an appeal to something perhaps beyond human nature. That, I thought, was well handled. And unfortunately, between the way it was translated on television and the way it was being received by this crowd, and look, we're talking about 14,000 people in a basketball arena.
Right. Did you see the difference? There was a slight difference, and again, this sounds like we're doing a little political chits here, but did you see there was a difference between the response to Governor Jan Brewer and the response to the previous governor, Janet Napolitano. Jan Brewer, there was some report that there's some booing in the hall. I didn't hear it, but there was more restrained, whereas Napolitano got a huge response.
Yes, and we should say this is the University of Arizona. It is perhaps the most liberal bastion in southern Arizona. Certainly, it would be a liberal bastion within Tucson and Tucson within southern Arizona, where the immigration issue is highly divisive live and where Jan Brewer is very much a representative of a very strong position against illegal immigration.
There were a lot of responses. There were a lot of reactions saying that this is the first kickoff to Obama 2012 campaign. I think that was just, you know, beyond contempt. I mean, they're just disgusting. But I couldn't help notice the comparison between a potential Obama rival, Sarah Palin, the video she made 12 to 14 hours prior to the Obama speech. And I guess if you have an opportunity, remember a few months ago, Dick Cheney and President Obama gave speeches the same day and everybody was comparing the meaning. I couldn't help but compare the tone of Sarah Palin and the tone of President Obama.
I think Sarah Palin very much invited that by putting out, after 4 days of silence.
Well, she'd sent an email to Glenn Beck.
Breaking her radio and television silence.
Yes.
After 4 days, she puts out a 7.5-minute videotape, which looks very much like it was produced from the Oval Office.
Right.
And she is clearly attempting to be part of the same narrative as the president on January 12th, 2011. She has chosen that moment herself and asked to be included in a comparative way.
Like millions of Americans, I learned of the tragic events in Arizona on Saturday, and my heart broke for the innocent victims.
And so in many ways, I thought that this part of Sarah Palin's speech showed exactly what many critics and supporters of Palin were hoping for, some kind of response, because, look, for better or for worse, Sarah Palin's name came up within minutes of the shooting. And do we think that targeting members of Congress for defeat is the same thing as inspiring people to get a Glock 9 and shooting them? Of course not. We always hear about targeting, and of course we don't hear some of the rhetoric like don't retreat, reload. But both said, look, in 2004, the DSCC, Democratic Senatorial
Absolutely.
Committee, targeted Republicans for defeat. We've used those words. Yes, the rhetoric is getting worse, but I think there were some parts of Sarah Palin's speech that really had the right tone until she went a step too far.
If you don't like a person's vision for the country, you're free to debate that vision. If you don't like their ideas, you're free to propose better ideas. But especially within hours of a tragedy unfolding, journalists and pundits should not manufacture a blood libel that serves only to incite the very hatred and violence that they purport to condemn. That is reprehensible.
All right, this term, blood libel, it has a long history.
Long history of anti-Semitism.
Basically, the blood libel was that Jews required the blood of Christian children, babies, for their religious rituals.
Right, Passover, things like that. And everybody's reaction was one of two things. Either Sarah Palin had no idea what she was talking about, and she just saw the phrase and just used it.
Possibly in the Wall Street Journal, where it had appeared the day before.
Right, or she knew exactly what she was doing, and she was comparing herself. For the record, the reason we're so focused on this was Gabrielle Giffords, who happens to be Jewish and happened to have been targeted. But the fact that Sarah Palin was not the victim here, and using blood libel, to me, was just a little over the top.
The impression I got, and this may not be what she thought, but the impression I got was that she saw the phrase, she thought it sounded very much like an extreme libel, and that that sounded pretty powerful to her, and she had seen it used in a similar context in print, and so she picked it up. I can't quite believe that this was her way of sending secret code to that particular group of Republican activists who threw their...
Conservative activists.
Conservative activists, and some of whom will vote in Republican primaries, that is focused particularly on the apocalyptic vision of the role Israel will play in the last things. And
well, look, I think the blood libel is an aside to the bigger story, which was this the right tone for Sarah Palin to take, you know, the same day as a memorial service? The message I got was that the rhetoric that I, Sarah Palin, used during the campaign was not incendiary, but the stuff I heard after the shooting, that's really incendiary. The point is, it was more her being the martyr, but more importantly, it was more of the pointing of fingers that was completely contrasted by the Obama speech later that evening.
Which I don't think works to her favor.
No.
I mean, the takeaway from all this is that Sarah Palin saw this as, in some sense or another, an attack on her and an attack on her people.
Well, which in many ways it was. I mean, her name was mentioned.
Yes. Oh, no. I'm not
right.
questioning that.
Right.
She saw it as an attack on her and her people as early as Saturday afternoon right. after the shooting had taken place. And she, taking a not untypical position, said, I'm not going to apologize for anything. I'm not going to accept that. I'm going to counterattack.
I'm not going to concede this, that words can
hurt.
Don't
retreat, reload.
Right.
This is a very common behavior in American politics, that when you're attacked, you don't defend, you counterattack.
Well, it has been Sarah Palin's modus from day one.
And James Carville's or any number of other people.
Yeah, but I mean, the fact is she is... We don't know what her plans are for 2012.
And she may not have plans.
She may not know that either. But I kind of think that nobody cared what Mitt Romney and Tim Pawlenty and Newt Gingrich and Haley Barbour had to say. Everybody wanted to know what Sarah Palin had to say. I'm not sure this was her shining moment. Look, she has succeeded because of her attacks on the lamestream media, the fact that she would just do it in her way. She'll do it by Twitter, by Facebook, by Glenn Beck, by The O'Reilly Show.
But she certainly doesn't want to get involved with the lamestream media.
And it's worked for her so far. I just somehow think that her focus and her timing was a bit off. But again, as I said, it's worked before, this throwing out the Twitter feeds and the Facebook stuff and the emails and things like this. But at some point, I think, unless we've changed the way we nominate presidents, but I think sometimes she's going to have to be more accessible to people who have questions. Okay, so obviously the next question is, what changes? I mean, we keep thinking that the rhetoric will be softened, but we know that when the House starts to work on repeal of health care...
Maybe next week.
Right, we may see some of that same rhetoric we saw in 2009,
oh, I think 2010. We will. I think we'll see most of it again. I think we may not necessarily see the kind of anger you were speaking of in the town halls.
There'll be references
in
to
August
Tucson
2009.
Throughout that debate.
The Democrats are going to try to change the subject. Instead of talking about criticism of the health care law and its relative unpopularity, they're going to be talking about Tucson, and they're going to be talking about the town halls of 2009 and the anger and the ginning up of opposition to the health care law by irresponsible people. I suspect that's what we will hear from the Democrats. That will change. What won't change, I would guess, would be the United States federal code respecting firearms. That's not going to change.
Well, I agree with it. And you know, we have to point out the fact that Jared Loughner bought his gun legally. I mean,
there's some dispute as to whether or not the gun shop should have denied him. There's some dispute as to whether or not some of the people who have had contact with him, law enforcement agencies, could have gotten in the way of his being
exactly.
a gun possessor.
What's the point of background checks when you're rejected from the Army because of either drug use, you're kicked out of college because of irrational behavior? I read in the Times this week that he was arguing that the number 6 was really the number 18. How do you get into an argument with somebody like that?
But he did not show himself to be a threat to himself or others, which is your basic standard, which decides whether or not someone is to be denied a gun.
And you need a magazine that holds 30 rounds of bullets?
It is going to be very difficult to change the law with respect to weapons in this country, because essentially both political parties have reached a point of agreement. The Democrats reluctantly, the Republicans more enthusiastically, that the Second Amendment applies to the average citizen, not just to well-regulated militias, as it may appear to some people. It applies to everyone, and that shy of wheeling around a howitzer or a nuclear weapon, you are guaranteed the right to arm yourself and arm yourself substantially. And it is extremely difficult to write a law that says you may have a gun that you can take hunting or that you can use to defend your home, but it can't have more than X number of bullets.
Well,
who knows how many bullets it's going to take to protect your home against an intruder tonight?
Well, this time it's a Republican, Peter King, the chairman of the Homeland Security Committee, who came up with this new proposal that bars people having guns within 1,000 feet of a public official.
Now, that's a practical law. That's an easily applied and enforced law.
Well, John Boehner, within minutes, I believe, of that proposal, said that it's not going to fly, and nobody thinks it's going to fly either.
And nobody thinks Peter King is going to fly.
And look, some members of Congress have gone the opposite way of saying that, you know, from now on when they attend rallies, they're going to bring guns. I don't think they're going to bring their own firearms. I don't think that's
an AK-47 across the chest.
That should not be the message that came out of Tucson. But what changed? Well, look, what changed after Columbine? What changed after Virginia Tech? Nothing. And
nothing.
I suspect that regarding the gun laws in this country, nothing changes after Tucson.
That's it for this week's Political Podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR. 'Cause it's time.